All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Ah, yes. Welcome once again to another edition of Veterans Radio, coming to you live, L-I-V-E, from the studios of WAAM. Somebody asked me what WAAM stands for. Okay? You got the W. Everybody gets W east of the Mississippi. And if you go west, it's... What is it? It's in... Yeah, W... I think it's an E. But anyway, W-A-A... What is it? K, that's it. Oh, our sharp staff, which I'm going to mention right now, is Derek. Derek, how you doing? You want to say a little something? Say a little something.
Hello, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
All right. And how about, our number one associate, our assistant, our screener. She's doing all the work right here. Nina. Yeah, she just waves now, folks. Okay, she did. She had her own. What do you call that? Sport club or fan club at one time. We were at the other station. But anyway, we're back. And what does WAM stand for? Ann Arbor. AA. Got it? A lot of people don't know that. You could win a beer. Well, we're here. Dale is doing Father's Day stuff. I want to say once again, happy Father's Day to all the fathers, military, non-military, all of you out there. Yep, we're the dads. We bring home the bacon, the bears, and the beans. And everything else. And with me, in the studio, and I do want to say something, as to Tom. Right, Tom?
Hello, Bob. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, Tom's a bon vivant media person, filmmaker. Did I miss anything?
Fundraiser for the military.
Oh, okay. And, well, you have a couple of announcements, Tom. Why don't you go ahead and give them to us?
Sure. First of all, we have a very big program coming up with Jim Harbaugh. He is going to be putting on a youth impact program with former San Francisco 49er Ricky Ellison, and they're doing that for underprivileged youth. They have military personnel mentoring our youth. A awesome program.
Yeah. And that's Harbaugh?
That's Jim Harbaugh, our very own.
Yeah, right. Coach, in case you all don't know what Jim, he's the coach, right? Manager? Coach.
He's the coach of the University of Michigan
Wolverine
football team.
You got it right here at Ann Arbor, Michigan, of course. So he's going to have, and they're mentoring, what are they mentoring the youth for?
Sports, and they're going to be training them and actually letting them play football in the big house.
Okay, when does this happen?
I will have more dates that I will fill you in on later.
Okay, is this a complimentary event? Is it free?
Absolutely. Jim does a wonderful thing for these youth.
And it's about a month from now, so is it open to kids, right?
Yes, and he gets inner city youth.
Well, it could be anybody, I'm sure. I don't think they're going to ask for
W-2s
or anything.
No, but he does make sure that he helps everybody. It's a great thing that the university's doing.
You had another announcement. What was that?
The other announcement is Mike Barwitz, former strength and conditioning coach for the University of Michigan football team, now the trainer for the New York Mets and also the Miami Dolphins, has decided that his strength and conditioning guy and rehab guy, Nick Lucius, wants to help military veterans get physically fit because they feel it has a mental impact on their overall wellness. And now Nick has stories on how he has saved the lives of our veterans by doing just that. So I'll have more on that at a later date.
So we're going to be following that story, too.
And last, we have the Warrior Games put on by the Department of Defense at West Point. I was just in New York City with the Bob Woodruff Foundation and Brett Marash, their chief financial officer. He's at the games today. Here's a shout out to he and his family who are representing the Woodruff Foundation helping our veterans.
Oh, that's great, the Woodruff Foundation. They do a lot for the veterans. In case you folks don't want to very quickly tell them about, but it's Bob Woodruff, right?
And yes, it's the Bob Woodruff Foundation, wounded in Iraq.
Iraq, blowing the bits, man. Just
yes,
about.
And his family and he decided to do something for our veterans. They're now appointed by the VA to do just that.
Wow.
Nationwide. And they come right here from Michigan. Both of them are from the Birmingham Bloomfield area. So our great thanks to what they do.
Good. Thank you, Tom, for that update. We'll be keeping on those stories from week to week here at Veterans Radio. Today's Father's Day, folks. Before I bring on my first guest, Michelle Anderson, who was a history teacher at John Glenn High School in Westland, Michigan, I want to read this. It came to us. It was an email. And we, from time to time, get very emotional emails. Because the program's emotional, we bring the stories. So here's one for Father's Day, which I think is very appropriate. And this is a quote all the way from the beginning. We got this right after we did a Dale was the host, must have been about 5 years ago. The quote, "The show no sooner ended when my son phoned me and said, 'Dad, I learned a lot about you today during your Veterans Radio interview. I just want to say thank you for what you did over there, and thank you for being my father.' Happy Father's Day." Yeah, well, we had a fife and drum come through the parking lot on that one. Must be a Father's Day group. We're connecting with all of our guests at this moment. So we'll be with we have three historians, of course, you know. So one of our favorite programs and with our listeners too has been Grit. Talk about leaders. I mean, these guys, they do the research. So they're going to get out there and really tell the good stuff. And we're not looking to beat anybody up, so that's not it. But first on with me is our school teacher who happens to be in Frankenmuth. No, not Germany. She's in Frankenmuth, Michigan. Nice place to visit in the summertime. They happen to have a military museum there, folks. Real nice one, Michigan Military Museum. Michelle Anderson. Michelle Anderson's a history teacher. John Glenn High School, Westland, Michigan. What caught my attention, we've been on the air, Dale and I and Gary, 13 years. We've never made the front page of the Free Press. In fact, we haven't been in the Free Press at all. And here, a month ago, front page, was Michelle Anderson in her classroom, and she was looking for veteran stories, which is what we do, folks. So it was a natural meld, a couple of phone calls, emails, and now here she is, Michelle Anderson. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much, and happy Father's Day to everyone.
Thank you very much. And you're in Frankenmuth, so you've got everything all set. And give us a few minutes, right?
Sure.
Okay. You wanted stories. What did you want the stories for?
The stories in the Free Press?
Yes.
You were
asking for stories.
Well, yes. We actually, my students and I work on several different projects. One of them is for the Veterans Oral History Project for the Library of Congress. And those are, of course, the stories of the living veterans to come in and be interviewed by my students. And then my students log their interview and put them into the Library of Congress. And we bring them back, the veterans back, for a USO dance that we put on at the end of the year, which is open and free to everybody. And we honor them at the dance.
Now, did you already have that USO dance?
This year we did. It was Persian Gulf to Present. It was April 27th. We try to follow the themes of for each year. We started with World War II, and then we went to Korean War, and then we went to Vietnam, and then this year was Persian Gulf to present.
Now, folks, Michelle's class, they conduct the Veterans History Program. You all know what that is, right? Everybody, shake your head. Sure, that's where we're taking autobiographies, I guess. What do they call that? Person-to-person. Oral history, that's right. And how many do you estimate that you have covered?
Well, we're well into our 70s. I think we finished number 78 this spring, 78 interviews, yeah.
Now, folks, here's somebody reaching out to veterans. Yeah, it's better. They're not just tying yellow ribbons around a tree or balloons or what. They're doing something, and that's available for every. First of all, we'd like to hear from anybody else that's doing things like Michelle, doing things for veterans. Michelle, we look at our children today, at the youth today, and some folks say there's apathy, ill feelings towards the military. What was inspiring that you felt to keep these children, high school, there we are, these high schoolers, I know, I'm 73, right, that keeps these high schoolers not just interested, but that have that fervor. What is it?
Well, a few years ago I was teaching, and my grandfather was a survivor of the Bataan Death March and a slave prisoner of the Japanese for 3.5 years. And when I was relaying some of his stories to my students, I was getting that apathy, which really disturbed me. And that's why I decided to do something about it. Now my students also conduct research. They pick out a World War II veteran. Last year was Vietnam. This year was our current, conflict since Vietnam. And they have to do the research on their veteran. They have to create a trifold display project. And then they actually have to display it to the community. So they're using their research. They know that it's going to be put on display. And they connect. They try to connect with those families. So I'm really trying to make it real. I want these students to know that it wasn't just over 400,000 World War II service personnel that we lost, or it was over 58,000, service personnel that we lost in Vietnam. I want them to put faces and names and stories together. And that kind of led me to this, the current project that we're working on, which is with National History Day and the American Battles Monuments Commission that you saw me in the newspaper for, with that project, in which my students also did some research, and I'm doing research, and then I'm actually going to go to the grave site of the veteran that I selected this year, who's buried in Epinal, France, and I'm going to do a eulogy to Norman, Sergeant Norman Stewart, right at his grave site in France this summer.
So you've got even more plans for your students to work with veterans. We'd like to invite you to be part of our education outreach. Would you like that?
I would love to be part of that.
That would be so cool. What else? Go ahead.
This year, as my students pointed out, we ran out of wars to cover, which we're very thankful for. So we decided that we wanted to do something for our veterans who are currently overseas and serving. I challenged them, and in one day they went out, and just one day, they raised over $600 to send care packages, and they decided that was not enough. So they decided that next year they would like to put out a challenge and have some type of a fundraising competition. They want to call it John Glenn versus the Armed Forces, and we're going to have some type of charity match to raise even more money so that we can send more care packages overseas.
Wow, that's exciting. Will you keep us? We're getting to the point of the segment. So will you keep us posted on all this, please? Please do.
Oh, absolutely.
And we want to know what your plans are. By the way, the three historians that are going to follow you on the program, I know they would all love to be part of this. These guys they did the research. They're going to grit. What is grit? What does it mean? And I know, so your kids are going to like this because of the stories about these about Eisenhower, Patton, Ridgway, etc. So it's more than just names and dates, and we'll get some of that to you, Michelle. Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You get the last word real quick. Go ahead.
Hey, just thank you very much, and I hope that everybody gets a chance to go to the American Battles Monuments Commission's website and look at our Understanding Sacrifice project. We've had 18 teachers looking and doing a lot of research on World War II veterans, and we'd like you guys to see them, so check us out.
Thank you very much. Good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be right back. You listen to Veterans Radio right on Talk Radio 1600 WAO. Stretch? Why are we stretching? No, we don't. We can. Let's just go to a... Right, but we're going to go to a break. We're going to... Yeah, give me a quick... why don't you do a PSA or something, okay? Give me a quick break. We'll be right back.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Say a prayer, say a prayer. Over there. You know who that was, Tom?
I sure don't.
It was George M. Cohan. Did you ever see the movie?
Yes.
It's a great movie. He dances up the wall, if you remember, in that. He really was a hoofer, James Cagney. And when he does that, I think it was the jockey scene. Watch him. He dances up the wall. Wow. Really something. Over there. And we're over there. It's Father's Day, and I have with me, once again, our three crack historians, Kevin Hemel, Bill Latham, and John McManus. And it looks like, we're still trying to get Kevin on, right? Right. Okay, so we're working on that. But anyway, Veterans Radio, Bill and John, welcome.
Hey, Bob.
Johnny, you there?
How are you today?
Good to be with you.
Yeah, John, you there?
Yep. How are you doing today, Bob?
Okay. I'm doing great, actually. It's really nice here. Where's it like, Missouri?
Yep. St. Louis, Missouri. It's hot as always.
Oh, okay.
Really like it in June.
Well, we're going to start with a couple of these right now while we're waiting to hook up with Kevin. And, which one? You know, I'm looking here. Here's one that caught my attention. Tiger Jack Wood. Who in the heck is he? Bill?
Give me a minute, Bob. I'm going to defer to John.
Okay.
Okay. Tiger Jack Wood was the commanding general of the 4th Armored Division, and he had an outstanding reputation as a kind of innovative and extraordinarily energetic armored leader. It's kind of too bad Kevin's not on, because he knows a lot about the dynamics between Patton and Wood, but suffice to say, Wood gained a lot of ground for Patton's army, and the unit had an excellent reputation. He was a kind of lead from the front sort of commander, but they ran afoul of each other in terms of their personal relationship. Eventually, Wood was eased out of command, ostensibly for health reasons, but there was more to it than that. I believe Wood was an excellent ground-level commander. I do think that he had a kind of a bit of a restive, I won't go so far as to say insubordinate side. He was an independent thinker, and that didn't always sit well with many of his bosses.
And, well, how would you rank his effectiveness as a commander?
I think among the armored division commanders, and we had some good ones, I think among them he would rank in the top two, in my view. I think he understood armored warfare and mechanized warfare, which, you know, much of the U.S. Army was designed around that by the summer 1944. think he understood that, you know, like few other generals did. So on the face of it, you would think he would get along just great with Patton. But I think maybe in some ways they were too alike.
Well, while we're still wanting to hook up with Kevin Hemel, and we're working on it, folks. He has, of course, extensive surgery research on Patton, and what I wanted to ask him, and I think I'm going to ask you and Bill. Then we're just going to go ahead with this. How much time we got? Good, we got 5 minutes. I was watching Patton the other day, and for many times I love that movie. And there's a scene just before the first battle in the desert with Rommel, and he's awakened in his bed. They're attacking. The Germans are coming. So that's the scene. He's awakened from his bed. He's getting dressed. He's got his shirt, tie, tunic, and looking sharp, getting ready, standing straight and tall. The music's in the background. I remember something, folks. When there is a movie, directors don't put stuff in. They don't. That's just the way the movies are. It's not done. It's not literary license. Let me tell you why. Because at that scene, and you got to look carefully, they're in the room. It's not a close-up. There he is, and he has his arms up, and his aide is reaching with both ends of the buckle with his pearl handle. Ivory. They're not pearl. I thought, right. Yeah, Tom's smiling. That's right, the ivory. And the actor, George C. Scott, stops for a second, takes two steps forward, opens a drawer on a bureau. This is in the movie. It's about 10 seconds. Pulls out a 45, a military-issued 45, and stuck it in his waistband, pulled his tunic down over it. Now, the director just didn't put that in. Either did the actor. Something happened. How? Why would he have three pistols, one in his waistband, and, oh, Kevin's there, good, one in his waistband, and sidearms. Kevin, did you hear that? Did you happen to hear that? Did we get Kevin yet? Kevin? Ah, there's still, okay, John, what about that? What did he need that third gun for? He had sidearms. What's going on?
Well, I think it's a shame we don't have Kevin yet, because he could probably tell you that specific instance, what maybe was in Patton's mind. But I can tell you maybe conceptually, a commander who has a kind of warrior's mentality like Patton might be thinking that he needs even one more weapon of last resort. That would just be my guess. But I'd be curious to hear what Kevin would say about that particular instance. But I have to admit, I don't know why Patton would have done that.
Hey, you folks let us know when Kevin's on the line, right? Yeah, they're hitting switches and doing all that. Tom, you got something to say.
Yes. My uncle fought against Rommel in North Africa. And when he did, he decided one day to write a letter to his wife. The rest of the troop went to the Mediterranean to swim. The Germans ambushed them and killed them to the last man. My great uncle was the only survivor from his troop, of which he suffered greatly from the rest of his life. He always asked, why me?
Well, did he carry an extra sidearm? You don't know.
I don't know. Okay. He's not with us anymore, but Rommel was quite an adversary.
Right, but this is not the story. The story is he stuck that 45 in his waistband. It was in the movie, and I said the directors just don't put that stuff in. So, I mean, somebody had to tell these people to do that, and it's a small part of the movie. When you look at it, he took that time to pull it out of a drawer, put it in his waistband. It was an Army issue 45. I carried one for 2 years. I can recognize it anywhere. And plus is then he raised his arms again, and they put I always want to say the ivory handle pistols around him. And I always thought that was – Bill, do you want to weigh in on that maybe?
Well, there's some reports that Patton's experience as a lieutenant in the Mexican campaign under Pershing persuaded him that an officer could never have enough weapons for self-defense. Having worn pistols in combat, I can tell you that, like it or not, leaders spend a lot of time riding in the back of vehicles, and quite frankly, it's hard to sit down with two pistols, much less three, sticking into your waistband. I honestly suspect the producer or the director of the movie added that for dramatic flair. I will also say, though, that Patton was a great showman and was not at all above making these sort of grand gestures solely for dramatic effect.
Well, that's...
Also, I would, you know, I'm not an expert on small arms weapon ranges, but as I recall, and you've carried a .45, Bob, the range is pretty limited, although the stopping power is.
Yeah, how much time we got, guys, before the break? What, 1 minute? Oh, we got 30 seconds. Okay, we're going to be right back here. Well, we've had a very interesting half hour, folks, but that's radio, live radio, right here from Talk Radio 1600 WAAM, Ann Arbor, Michigan. We'll be right back right after this message. Yeah, that was Washington Post, I believe. Was that right? Is that Washington Post? Yeah, okay. Well, I guess we got everybody on. Kevin, did you happen to hear that little piece on? By the way, Kevin Hemel, welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks. Good to be here, Bob. How you doing today?
Oh, sometimes it takes a little bit to get the communication going. We got it. Did you hear that little bit about the movie Patton and the extra weapon that you have to look carefully? Because it's not a big part of the scene, that he stuck in his waistband before they put the two Colt 45 ivory handled around his waist. What was that third gun for?
Well, I think that was the director's choice to give Patton that impression of, you know, a weapon in every pocket. He actually, I heard mentioned earlier about that he was inspired with his weapon from the incursion into Mexico, and what happened was he got caught in a gunfight with a single ivory-handled pistol and had to reload in the middle of the gunfight, so he swore to always carry at least two weapons on him. And so by the time you get to North Africa, he would strap on the two ivory-handled pistols. Now, he never mentioned anything about carrying a third weapon. I've never seen that in his diaries or his letters. He would often talk about his choice of which pistol to wear. But I never saw any reference to three. But what eventually happens after North Africa is he only starts wearing one again because he says, you know, I'm kind of old and wearing two pistols is really heavy on my waist. And that's really why by the time you get to Sicily, he's only got one ivory-handled pistol on his waist.
Well, next time, folks, you all watch the movie Patton, look for that scene. It's 5 seconds, if even that, but I thought it was very poignant. And, you know, we say director, the director, I happen to be in a couple of movies here, right? I was working with Clint Eastwood at one time. And just the directors just don't plain do that. So I often wondered about that, and I wanted to bring that up. But anyway, we're all back. We've got everybody together right here. And now we get to start on grit. What does it mean? What does it mean to have grit and be in the American military? We have Norm Cota. Norm Cota, John, I think you can handle that. Norm Cota, tell us about him.
Yeah, Norm Cota was a combat leader, really the First Order. His shining moment in his career, I would say, is, of course, at Omaha Beach. He was the assistant division commander of the 29th Infantry Division, and very much a lead from the front kind of guy in taking the Vierville draw, the western side of Omaha Beach that day. His one of his aides, Lieutenant Jack Shea, left behind a lot of really good firsthand stuff about where Cota went that day, what he did, who he spoke to. We have a nice record about what happened, in addition to, you know, Cota's own perspective and many other soldiers who saw him. And his performance that day was so well regarded throughout the upper reaches of the Army that eventually it gets him command of his own division, the 28th Division, which is Pennsylvania National Guard, the Bloody Bucket Division. And if historians really don't regard him as highly as a division commander as they did as an assistant division commander, what he did at Omaha Beach. And the reason for that is he's a big part of the fiasco that happens at the Hurricane Forest later that year in 1944, in the fall, which is really, I think, in my view, the U.S. Army's low point in the entire campaign in Europe in terms of leadership, casualties, hopelessness, all of this stuff is just absolutely awful. And although this wasn't entirely Cota's fault, he had some culpability for it. He also, by the way, too, he was not a lucky commander as a division commander, because later on his division bore the brunt of much of the German offensive in the Battle of the Bulge. And though the division performed extremely well, again, the reviews for Cota himself and some of the decision-making that he had and his actions were not quite as high. And on the heels of that, after that difficult circumstance, his division ends up fighting the Colmar Pocket, which isn't as well known, but it's a terrible winter battle in January, February 45, in which, you know, the division performed pretty well, but it was done in terms of any combat readiness after that. So North Dakota has this interesting career where, you know, he performs magnificently at Omaha Beach with the highest kind of grit that we would view, but then doesn't perform quite as well as at a higher level.
Did he really say those that are on the beach are the ones that
absolutely not. And I'm glad you brought that up.
I'm glad I did, too.
The myth that comes out of the movie The Longest Day, of course, Robert Mitchum played Cota in that movie and played him pretty well. But what they did is they took the words from Colonel George Taylor, who was the commander of the 16th Infantry of the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One, on the opposite side of Omaha Beach, who went up and down the beach all day saying that only two kinds of people are going to be on this beach, the dead and those who are going to die. Now get the hell off the beach. And they put those words into Norm Cota's mouth for the movie. And I think that's very unfortunate. Taylor, one of the things I found out in research for a book I did on the Big Red One at Omaha Beach, and the book is called The Dead and Those About to Die, is that Taylor had that phrase in mind many months before D-Day, wrote about it in a memo. So those words have become immortal, and I would hope they'd be associated with him because he's the true author.
Bill Latham, you have anything to add?
I would just point out that while Cota did not say that famous quote, he did coin the phrase, Rangers lead the way, meeting the 5th Rangers on that day. He ordered the Rangers to take the lead on the move inwards and said, well, God, then Rangers lead the way. There you go.
Well, that was very poignant. I'm sure they got the message, right? Right. And Kevin, you want to weigh in on Cota? Kevin?
Me okay?
Yeah, do you want to weigh in on Cota?
Yes, I would say that the landings at Beerville Draw were a fiasco between 6 a.m. and 10 a.m., and it was him landing on the beach, helping organize the Rangers and Company C of the 116th by standing and walking around that beach that really inspired the men. He was one of the first men through the wire after they blasted it with Bangalore torpedoes. And there's an eyewitness account from a guy from Company C that said after he made his way up the hill to the east of Beerville Draw, he said by the time they got to the top and started heading towards the town, they were greeted by Norm Cota spinning a pistol on his finger and asking them what took them so long. And I think, you know, when we think of grit, we think of aggressiveness and risk-taking. But there's that calm leadership in the middle of that sort of maelstrom that really kind of personifies Norm Cota.
All right, we're weighing in. John, real quick, give me a score.
I guess about a 7.5.
7.5, okay. Bill?
Well, I'd give him an 8. I think the right guy in the right place on one day at one time. He was the general we needed and saved a lot of lives. So I'll give him an 8.
Kevin?
I'd give him an 8 because that was the sort of point in time that he was needed most, and he was there. And for whatever failings he may have had in the future, I think that one experience on D-Day pushes him high up on the number rating.
You know, folks, it really, what a day. It was the longest day. There'll never be another date like that, not in my history, and I think a lot of folks listening. That was it, the 6th of June, 1944. What a day to remember. Whew. Well, let's go across around the world to the other side of the world, Pacific Ocean. We've never had a Pacific Theater commander. So the first name that I have from Kevin is Eichelberger. Eichelberger. Did I say that right? Eichelberger. Tell us about
Eichelberger.
Him. Robert Eichelberger. Go ahead.
You got it. Well, I knowing John so well, I know that he can speak better on this, but Eichelberger was a division and army commander underneath General MacArthur, and really had a sort of unforgiving job. I mean, he was fighting in the jungles of New Guinea and all the way up to the Philippines, always on a shoestring with supplies, and always with pressure from MacArthur for more results with less to do it with. Yet he managed to accomplish a great deal. And, you know, whereas Eisenhower would always give credit to Bradley or Patton or any other army commander underneath him, MacArthur was dead set against that. You know, everything that the Americans achieved, it was MacArthur's name had to be applied. And he even told Eichelberger at one time, you know, if you do this successfully, I'll give you press. You know, it was an unenviable position to be a division or army commander underneath MacArthur, but yet he pulled it off, you know, saved a lot of his men's lives and really drove home attacks to the enemy.
Kevin, tell us about that.
I think John would probably be able to chime in a little bit better than me.
Oh, okay.
This.
Let's go back to John. John?
Yeah, I'd like to add something about Eichelberger. I just got back from researching his papers at Duke University and feel like I've gotten to know him pretty well. Eichelberger has three shining moments in the Pacific War. Bumia in New Guinea in November, December 1942, which was a horrendous battle where the conditions were every bit as bad as the Japanese, and the Japanese were tough enough as it was. Eichelberger is, to some extent, the savior of that for MacArthur. Hollandia, which is a key moment in the entire Pacific War, an invasion of New Guinea in April 1944, and then Biak, which happens a couple months later. Eichelberger is really the best army commander in the U.S. Army that we've never heard of. He's sort of MacArthur's fireman, and in terms of grit, he's kind of off the charts. But he ends up resenting MacArthur and his colleague Walter Kruger for the rest of his life because he feels that his accomplishments were never as well known as they should have been. And, you know, to some extent that was true. But the other thing that I found out in my research is that three different times George Marshall attempted to get Eichelberger reassigned to Europe, probably to command the First Army that General Omar Bradley eventually got. And each time MacArthur scotched that, and while he kept Eichelberger sort of in the shadows. And I think Eichelberger resented that for the rest of his life because he felt that he probably would have had the key command at Operation Overlord, but that's simply the way it worked out.
What was his final rank?
His final rank when he actually retired in 1948 was Lieutenant General. However, subsequently, the Department of Defense, which comes after the War Department in the 50s, decided that anyone who held Army rank in Army command in World War II would eventually get four-star rank, at least in retirement. And so in 1954, Eichelberger is retroactively promoted to four-star general.
Bill, you want to weigh in?
Well, I just want to say that any senior officer who could put up with MacArthur for 6 years rates pretty high in my book. He was, unless you were part of the inner circle in MacArthur's staff, it was a pretty leading troops under MacArthur's command was a pretty thankless task, and like Eisenhower before him, Eichelberger struggles under that burden, and so when we get to the rankings, I think he gets extra credit for that.
Kevin, weigh in. What's the score?
I'm going to give Eichelberger a 10 for fighting enemies in front and behind him. And one thing I just we should mention, there's a famous line from World War II where MacArthur replaces the commander underneath him at Buna with Eichelberger, and his orders to Eichelberger are, take Buna or don't come back alive. And he managed to do it. So I'm going to give him a 10+.
Wow. Two 10s. Bill.
I'm right there with a 10. The fighting in the Pacific was absolutely horrific. Our troops were, you know, undersupplied, undertrained, and Eichelberger, you know, maintains firm command despite MacArthur's overbearing supervision. So I give him a 10 easy.
Well, folks, we've only had one other complete score, and that was General Gavin. And he got three 10s. That was I've never heard of this guy. So all you students that are listening, I'm going to spell that last name. Eichelberger. Eichelberger. You heard it first right here. I never heard of the guy. Tom, did you ever hear of the guy?
I sure didn't.
No, and we've been studying this stuff a long time. Nope, never did. Thank you. Well, since that's a great segue, we're not going to go to the third break. Right, folks? Right. Let's just go right on through. So the segue is MacArthur. What? That couldn't be any better. Here was the guy with an ego bigger than the Goodyear blimp. He was everything. Or was he everything? Who wants to start? Bill?
Well, my familiarity with MacArthur focuses primarily on the Korean War, where he is pretty much a disaster, but I think he deserves a great deal of credit for his leadership during World War II, despite his massive paranoia and his even more massive egotism. That is counterbalanced by his failure to adequately prepare the Philippine Islands for defense against what is clearly a significant threat of Japanese invasion. He had several years to prepare for that, and his plans were largely a disaster, particularly his employment of air reconnaissance and his inability to stop the Japanese on their landing beaches.
Did he want to be emperor of the Philippines?
Well, and you know, he was the field marshal of the Philippines. And there is rumors, I think, largely founded. I can't get specific, so I won't go into great detail. But there's discussion that his compensation from the Philippine government was unseemly. Evidently, the Philippine regime rewarded him with a large amount of gold.
Ah, so they were generous.
Field Marshal, I'm hoping Kevin or John can talk to that in more detail.
All right.
Where I will give MacArthur very high marks is his leadership in World War One, where even there he's seen as a prima donna, but he behaves fearlessly and does, on several occasions, expose himself to enemy fire in the front lines. Totally unarmed, by the way, except for a riding crop and a soft cap, unlike George Patton with his three pistols.
By the way, folks, I think these guys, just about all of them, have huge egos. And yeah, they might feel like prima donnas, but that's what makes them what they are. That's the way I feel. John, weigh in.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that, Bill. I actually found the documentary evidence of exactly what you've discussed. The Philippine government paid MacArthur $500,000 at the time when he was evacuated from the Philippines in 1942. In addition, they paid several members of his staff money too, including Richard Sutherland, his chief of staff, $75,000. And that, you know, of course, that's always a lot of money, but it was a heck of a lot of money in 1942. Subsequently, Eisenhower claims that in the wake of that, when Eisenhower was working in Washington, D.C., in the Office of War Plans, that the Philippine president, Manuel Quezon, offered him a retainer of some $60,000, $70,000 for his work in the Philippines. Eisenhower claimed that he turned that down, and I think that's true. And I've always thought that was the measure of the two men in many respects. MacArthur was a man who I think is one of the most overrated commanders in American military history, though we should not diminish his importance. It's two different things. He was very important, but as for his performance, there were monumental screw-ups in both World War II and, as Bill mentioned, in Korea.
Well, I'm going to – Kevin, I'll get to you in a second. Bill, I want to go I want to go right back to you because I know that you studied the Korean War and – Was Inchon brilliant, yes or no?
No.
Ah! Tell us why.
It was completely predictable. In fact, the Russians had sent anti-ship mines to the Koreans, and had the mines arrived in time, Flying Fish Channel off of the beaches at Inchon would have been heavily mined, and the Incheon landings would have been a disaster. Furthermore, the strategy of using amphibious capability to outflank your enemies was an old and favorite tactic of U.S. forces, and particularly of MacArthur. And so the notion that MacArthur would use Marine Corps forces to conduct an amphibious landing on the flanks of the North Korean army really came as no surprise at all. It was effective largely because the North Koreans ignored Chinese and Soviet warnings until the last minute, at which point it was too late, and because Incheon and Seoul were defended by rear echelon troops. And so for those reasons, Incheon was a big success, but it was hardly the brilliant maneuver that it was depicted as in the media.
Kevin, Incheon, if they didn't do that, and would Korea, I mean, they were pushed all the way back to the Pusan perimeter. What would that mean? I mean, was that the end of Korea? Had they had not the Incheon, what was left? The A-bomb? What?
No, you know, while they were planning the Incheon invasion, they were also reinforcing the Pusan perimeter in order to have a breakout, which occurs. It gets off to a slow start, but then picks up speed. And the sort of pincer movement between Incheon and the breakout of the Pusan perimeter fails to really capture the North Korean army. A lot of them make it through and proceed north. So it wasn't as much as a doomsday scenario. I mean, the American army had been pushed back in North Africa with a bad bloody nose. They got pushed back in Belgium and Luxembourg during the Battle of the Bulge. The same thing happened in Korea, and there's a number of options you have to get back on the offensive. Incheon is not necessarily your only one.
Bill, yep. Was he really going to drop the atomic bomb?
No, he wasn't. He did suggest creating a layer of nuclear waste between North Korea and China to prevent the Chinese from reinforcing the North Koreans. It was a pretty cockamamie idea. He later wanted to use nuclear weapons against Chinese targets. But the U.S. government never seriously considered that. However, Truman inadvertently terrified our NATO allies when a reporter asked him whether the administration was considering nuclear weapons, and Truman, without giving it enough thought, said, "We're considering all weapons."
Wow.
One of several examples where Truman answered a question too quickly and too candidly. Truman also famously never said that Korea was a police action. That was a phrase used by a reporter who said, "Mr. President, would you say it was like a police action?" And Truman said, "Yes, you could say that." So he's had to wear that around his neck for the last 65 years. Again, because, well, it was a different era, and media relations weren't the fine art that they are now.
No.
But MacArthur's conduct in Korea particularly after Incheon, is just unforgivable. And I think it it severely tarnishes his reputation and his record. He is negligent to the point of Truman had every right to fire him in December, but told his advisors that he wasn't going to kick a man when he was down.
Okay.
A gesture that MacArthur had no appreciation for.
Now, John, so he's still in charge. MacArthur's still the commander, and now we have a president. They're at odds. So Truman, what was and I'm listening to this. So I still want to know what was the main. Was it the fact that he was going to cross into China with troops or drop the bomb that was the result of his being taken off command? What's your feeling?
The main point of disagreement between these two at that point was what the Korean War is all about. The Truman administration, having absorbed this massive Chinese and North Korean counterblow that happens, you know, from November 1950 onward and pushes the UN forces back across the 38th parallel into South Korea, has no stomach anymore for the idea of rolling back communism. In other words, eliminating the North Korean regime altogether and courting the possibility of a larger conflict with China. He wants containment. You contain communism by making sure it doesn't spread to South Korea, and that was the UN mandate when the war began. So the Truman administration is thinking along those lines, whereas MacArthur still wants rollback. He wants to fight it out with communism in Asia at that point. So he ends up, MacArthur ends up defying the orders of his commander-in-chief and basically making policy in the field. And by the way, this wasn't the first time that he'd done that. He had a history of doing that in World War II. So, you know, this is a tendency he'd had his whole career, and it continues now in Korea. The stakes are too high, and Truman felt he could not allow this anymore. So in April 1951, he relieves him, and that ends the general's career. And, of course, containment is what ultimately triumphs, and it ends up as a limited war for the limited objective of simply securing South Korea.
Old soldiers never die, they just fade away. Right? Something like that, guys. Kevin, you get a word here. You get the last word. Go ahead, Kevin. Comment on pull us all together.
Sure. Old soldiers never die, they simply fade away is the great lie that MacArthur gave when addressing the joint sessions of Congress. He refused to fade away. In fact, tried running for president unsuccessfully, and tried to keep his name out there in the headlines as sort of a wise military thinker. But, you know, MacArthur in this list, you know, I got to give him his aggressiveness, but boy, his ego, and it's all about Douglas MacArthur to me, just pulls him down. The best part of MacArthur I've always felt is that his life, his biography, and his family's biography is sort of the great sort of measurement of American military history in the 20th century and before, because his father earned the Medal of Honor leading an attack during the Civil War, leading a Wisconsin regiment. And MacArthur was born on a military post, and just about every significant military activity for the first half of the 20th century, he was involved in. You know, to put it on a personal level, when I was, I guess, in high school, I read William Manchester's American Caesar and walked away thinking, this is the most brilliant commander ever produced by the United States. And over the decades, with conducting research and reading into it, just my opinion of the guy has gone lower and lower. And, you know, I've looked extensively into Patton's career, too, and that thing has maintained its high level. And I think that's the key. A lot of these soldiers in the American Army, and you know, and people in general, the ones who are really concerned about their legacy are the ones that really kind of trip up, where the people that are just focused on the task at hand, like a Norm Coda on a single day of combat, they really rise to the occasion. And so it's really the people that have the sort of simple, direct, we have a mission to accomplish, let's do it. Those people, I think history is much kinder to than those who are looking to place themselves in the context of history.
Bill, give them a score.
0.
Whoa. Kevin?
3.
Oh. John?
I'll be a little kinder than my colleagues. I guess I'll give them a 4.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you all. Thank you all for being on the program this Father's Day. Thank you all. Y'all going to come back. We're going to do this again. If you want to know anything about the historians, go to bob@veteransradio.net. I'll give you the information. Bill, Kevin, John, thank you. We'll all be on another time. 10 seconds, 9. The band is warming up. 8, 7. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Next week, you are dismissed.